Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When Tulsa writer Hunter Hal Cates was still in school, an offhand remark by a family member about the book he was reading would spur his own long search to tell a story about a 1950s-era murder case. The book was To Kill a Mockingbird, and the story was something similar happened to your grandfather, Tulsa attorney Elliot Howell. In early 1953, a Cherokee named Buster Young Wolf confessed after 6 days of interrogation to the rape and murder of his 11-year-old relative. When he recants that confession, saying it was coerced, public defender Howell steps in. While the case is long forgotten today, it made news nationwide, putting Tulsa on the map alongside of the International Petroleum Exposition, which was then underway here in the city. Cates recounts the story in his book, Oklahoma's Atticus, An Innocent Man and the Lawyer Who Fought for Him. It tells the story of the investigation and trial. Cates says the story is a tale of two cities, the oil-rich downtown and midtown areas of the city alongside its depressed, poverty-stricken areas of North Tulsa, of two newspapers taking opposite opinions about the case, and of two Indians, one on trial for his life, the other representing him in the court. It's a great read about Tulsa history. Cates will have a book event this Thursday at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books, and he joins me today to talk about his new book, Oklahoma's Atticus. Hunter Cates, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
The story of Oklahoma's Atticus is the story of the death of Phyllis Jean Warren back in early 1953 in the trial of Buster Young Wolf, who was accused of murdering her. Your grandfather was Young Wolf's attorney. So was this a story you heard growing up, or how did you first hear about this case?
I think the situation was, as I was probably reading To Kill a Mockingbird in elementary school, and so my mom just casually mentioned, hey, something similar happened to your grandfather. Now, I'm not suggesting that Harper Lee got the story from this event, but she just said something similar happened. And so we had kept the magazines. It was covered in Red Book and then likewise Newsweek. And so I had read it, you know, cover to cover in those periodicals. And so that's how I knew about it, was just kind of that. But the articles were, they were very much just the plot, the basic plot. I had no idea how deep the story went until I started actually researching this book.
So what made you decide to write about it?
So I had written about it as a brief version for the This Land Press a while ago, and a teacher of mine, Professor Jolie Jensen, formerly of the University of Tulsa, she read the article and suggested that it could be made into a lengthier book if I were to actually explore some of these issues. David Grand spoke in Tulsa not too long ago, actually, at the University of Tulsa, and he made it clear that in regards to the Osage Reign of Terror, in his book, The Killers of the Flower Moon, there's just so much history in this situation that's been completely forgotten and even lost. And I didn't want that to happen with this story. So it was kind of a, I don't want to say race against time, but there was an element of urgency to it that nobody knew about it. And those that did, older attorneys, it's kind of passed on into almost mythology. So I wanted to record this history because if not me, then who?
And of course, it's sort of a who's who of Oklahoma and Tulsa history because people like J. Howard Edmondson, who'd go on to become governor and a senator at some point, he features in this story.
Yeah, it was amazing to me because I'd written about this before, read about it. And so the Newsweek and Red Book coverage, it was written in the early 50s, so you don't know what happens to these people necessarily. I knew about Edmondson, of course. But doing the research for the book, it astounded me just how many, it, as you said, was a who's who of this was being a launching point because, of course, J. Howard Edmondson would go on to be governor of the state of Oklahoma and likewise a senator. At the time, he was the assistant county attorney for Robert Wheeler, and J. Howard Edmondson was actually one of the primary instigators of the case against Buster Young Wolf. And then likewise, you mentioned Harry Stege. He conducted one of the lie detector tests. And then another character is Troy Gordon, who I think a lot of people who have been in Tulsa for a long time will recognize that name. He wrote a column for a number of years until his passing in the early 80s, but he was the young cub courthouse reporter at the time who wound up being very influential and instrumental in my grandfather's case.
You said your mother had shown you these articles when it says, you know, Atticus Finch. This is, your grandfather was sort of an Atticus Finch here in Oklahoma.
Right.
Was this a story that was talked about in the family, or was this something you really had to dig up?
To be honest with you, I think everything I told you is all we really talked about is my mom just, because,
you know, you don't want to talk about murder trials at family gatherings.
Yeah, exactly. Probably for the best. But also, my grandfather was the strong, silent type, so we didn't hear a lot of war stories. honestly didn't hear a lot about his childhood. Thankfully, so much of it was documented, which I'm grateful for. I know a lot of people don't have that. And then in regards to this trial, quite literally, I tried to, you know, talk a little bit about it. And it's like, oh, yeah, they made a movie about it in regards to Kill a Mockingbird. Not suggesting that he thought that, but he was glib and kind of comical about it.
Yeah. Now, your grandfather, Elliot Howe, had worked in the county attorney's office, and then election comes. The Democratic county attorney wins instead of the Republican county attorney. And so he's out of a job, and he becomes a public defender. You tell a bit about his background, and he had this strong affinity for the underdog that you write about that came from his upbringing. Your grandfather was part Indian growing up, and so he went to Shalako Indian School, where he learned to fend for the underdog.
He really didn't have a choice because he was essentially orphaned by the age of 10. His father was murdered, quite literally, and then his mother figuratively was murdered because the doctor refused to treat her because she owed bills. It's kind of astounding. Yeah. Live in a world like that. But anyway, so he was orphaned, and he had, all of his brothers and sisters were sent to live with family in Virginia, but he didn't. He was the only one who his Virginia relatives wanted to take, and he didn't want to be separated from his brother. And his brother had far more native features than he did, but he didn't want to be separated from his brother. So as you said, he was sent to Shalako in the late 20s, and he didn't really fit in there as a consequence of being lighter skinned. And he got into several fights his first day, and he knew that if he didn't get into these fights, he would be just bullied for the remainder of his time there. So it was a really tough experience for him. And that, as you indicated, gave him a lifelong dislike and distrust of bullies. And so in the Buster Youngwith situation, he recognized that this is what this was, is that some people in a position of power were bullying this Cherokee Indian guy because they didn't think that there would be any consequences for it. And in many situations, there wouldn't have been any consequences for it. But because of my grandfather's upbringing, because of his native heritage, this wasn't going to be that situation. History is rife with situations comparable to this whenever people who are different, people of color, people of different socioeconomic backgrounds are bullied, picked on, and taken advantage of. And this is a situation where they stood up and said, no, not this time. And that's really what inspired me about it, beyond just the fact that it was a family story.
Well, the book tells the story of Phyllis Jean Warren, who was an 11-year-old girl who grew up in an area of deep poverty on North Yale. And in fact, during the course of the trial, there would be a Tulsa World front page article on this whole area that was sort of belied Tulsa's reputation of a most beautiful city. It was an area of very deep poverty. Tell us about her disappearance. This is what spurred the case.
Well, as you said, the area was just unimaginable poverty. And in fact, a lot of everyday Tulsans had no idea it existed. It was kind of just a slum town. Essentially, they basically lived like medieval serfs. It was dirt floors. And so Buster Youngwith lived in this neighborhood alongside Phyllis. Phyllis was actually his aunt. So Phyllis's brother had married Buster's mother. So that kind of shows the collusion of that situation. But anyway, on March 13th, 1953, was the last time that anyone had seen Phyllis Jean Warren alive. She had disappeared and then was gone for about 3 weeks, and they launched an investigation. And as everyone knows, within the first 24 to 48 hours, if you don't get some leads, then you're in trouble. And this is a situation where they didn't have anything for several weeks, and so they were starting to lose hope. And then they actually found her 300 yards from where she lived, which made everything more suspicious, and I get into that in the book. But yeah, just a happy-go-lucky, carefree kind of tomboy kid who, as I said, vanished and was eventually found murdered, and Buster made a very convenient suspect.
And of course, the case was crazy from the get-go because a spiritualist was involved who messaged where the body would be found.
Yeah, divined where the body was. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unreal, and this story was likewise covered by a lot of True Detective-style magazines, and it's not hard to see why. Because, yeah, as you mentioned, there's a 72-year-old spiritualist woman who lived in the neighborhood who people would go to her for seances. And so once all hope was lost, they went to go see her, one of Phyllis's sister-in-laws, actually. And anyway, yeah, the spiritualist woman said this is where the body would be buried. And they checked that area, or checked around that area, and once again didn't turn up anything. And then a few weeks later, lo and behold, there's the body.
Found by the father.
Yes.
But the attention focused on Buster Youngwith, who was, again, a relative. Actually, the girl who was younger than her was his aunt.
Right.
And why did attention focus on him?
For one, because he did indeed tell a lie. He said that he was out that night at the movies, when in fact he was actually out drinking with his father and his brother and a neighbor, because it was his birthday that night. And so anyway, he was out drinking, but he was on parole because in late 1952, he had actually robbed a grocery store. And so he was on parole, and so drinking would have been against his parole. So he thought, well, you know, I'll lie about this, or else I'll go to prison. Well, that wound up being, in order to lie to get out of prison, he became suspect number one in a murder investigation. But even still, even catching him in the lie, the evidence didn't add up. And so that was where things really got egregious in the county's treatment of him. Is so, yes, they caught him in a lie. Yes, he appeared nervous, but who wouldn't be nervous in that situation? So it became increasingly obvious that they decided from the word go, as my grandfather put it, that Buster was their suspect, and anything else they put blinders on.
Yeah, and he was taken into custody and held for about 6 days of nonstop interrogation.
Right, one after the other. It was almost a revolving door, because county attorneys, deputies would just one after the other ask him the same questions over and over again. Why did you lie? What were you really doing? So on and so forth. And anyone who's gone without sleep can probably relate to this, even just a little bit of sleep. And this is over the course of, like you said, 5 to 6 days of very little sleep, practically no food or water. Probably didn't know what was true and what was fiction. It honestly got to the point wherever he thought that confessing to the murder was the only way out, and actually go into the book about false confessions and the various types of false confessions. And unfortunately, criminal justice is replete with situations just like Buster's, where people think, I'm going to confess to this because this is the only way out, and then I'll recant that confession after the fact. The problem is that once that confession has situated itself, it's very hard to get people to change their minds. And so that was the big crux throughout the entire trial, was that Buster confessed. Now, even though the confession was coerced, and it was clear it was coerced, that was all the county had. They didn't have any hard, tangible evidence. But at the same time, my grandfather still had his work cut out for him, because Buster had confessed to the murder, and people just couldn't relate then, and frankly, a lot can't relate now, to the idea that someone confessed to something certainly so heinous that they didn't do.
My guest today is Hunter Hal Cates. He's an author and a marketing professional, and he is the author of Oklahoma's Atticus, An Innocent Man and the Lawyer Who Fought for Him. That lawyer was his grandfather, Elliot Hal, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be talking about the book Thursday at 7 o'clock in the Magic City Books event. One of the things you do in the book is you really try to set the stage of where Tulsa was in 1953. You know, it had come through this huge post-war boom and was in the midst of booming at the time. Mm-hmm. Oil wealth had built it. And you really do spend a lot of time in the book setting the stage. You go back to the Tulsa Race Massacre and sort of recount that history at times during the book. What was the reason for taking all that time to spend this deep background about the city?
I think the value of that is that so much of the book is concerned about haves versus have-nots. And so Tulsa was, at this time, the oil capital of the world. And I think a lot of us have forgotten just what that meant. Likewise, I've forgotten what that meant. So I, as a reader, was curious what that really meant, just how important Tulsa's oil reputation was. And so I wanted to establish that idea of this city with a lot of oil wealth, and then as a consequence, a lot of the beauty and the accomplishment of that. But then at the same time, there was this other part of the city where, frankly, lawless, because a guy was arrested for something he didn't do. So that was the point of that, is I wanted people to, I didn't want it to just be a place. I wanted Tulsa to be a character in this story. So that was Tulsa's, essentially, it's abridged biography to establish that this isn't just the location of the story. This is very clearly part of the story. But I would also, and I do in the book, take pains to point out that the idea of haves versus have-nots or A Tale of Two Cities is not unique to Tulsa in any stretch of the imagination. You go to any city in the nation, any city in the world, and there are quote-unquote bad areas and good areas. So I just wanted to define what that meant for Tulsa.
Yeah, and what also plays almost a minor character in the book is the idea that at the time of this murder and trial, the International Petroleum Exposition, the whole world is descending on Tulsa for the IPE.
Yeah, some of that was inspired by the fact that I had recently read Eric Larson's The Devil in the White City, and so he had done the biography of H.H. Holmes as contrasted to the World's Fair, and I thought that that was really cool. But, I mean, at the same time, this quite literally happened. The biggest International Petroleum Exposition in the event's history. It was happening quite literally at the same time. And so I thought that that was fascinating. So I wanted to give some backstory to that of, on the one hand, you have newspapers with the headline being about this murder trial, but then also there's headlines about the International Petroleum Exposition. And so the International Petroleum Exposition, we remember it because of the IPE building where the fair is held every year. But for decades, quite literally, this was where all of the most important people in the oil industry met to make deals. And then it expanded beyond that to essentially become a fair, a world's fair surrounded by petroleum. And so that was just incredible to me. And like I said, it was happening at the same time. And so that kind of likewise played into the haves versus have-nots situation. Is here's this thing that it's a celebration of the lifeblood of the world, but certainly this city, contrasted with a murder trial wherever someone is being railroaded for something they didn't do. So I thought that was a very intriguing parallel.
And of course, this is a story that played out in the newspapers, and you have the two newspapers almost taking different approaches towards this event and the trial. You have the Tulsa Tribune, who they're literally on the scene after the confession happens, where the police authorities and the sheriff's authorities are taking the suspect out to the scene of a crime to reenact the crime for the Tulsa Tribune.
Well, actually, so here's where things get a little kooky is the Tulsa Tribune, as you pointed out, it became a situation where the Tulsa Tribune was clearly from the perspective of the county attorney's office. And then likewise, the Tulsa World, as time went on, saw things from my grandfather's point of view and saw things from Buster's situation. And what was fascinating about this to me is neither one of them was lying. The word, and some people wonder what I may mean by that, the word fake news is spread out so much, and fake news is essentially a synonym for lying. But this isn't a situation where ever the Tulsa Tribune printed stuff that was not factual. It's just it was very much from the perspective of the county attorney's office. And so me reading it here with 60 years later, even I was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And then I can only imagine what it must have been like as a reader back then, reading these two newspapers, the Tulsa World in the morning, the Tulsa Tribune in the afternoon, wondering, yeah, how is this going to turn out? Because one makes it sound like Buster's innocent, and then another makes it sound like, no, he's guilty. And then also you might have had your own preconceived prejudices going into reading this. And in fact, that's what made it hard to pick jury members, is they had to go through something like 60 to 70, because everyone had an opinion. So the event you're referring to, what's interesting about it, is actually the Tulsa World who followed him. Huh. But so the situation as was is that the Tulsa Tribune, being the afternoon paper, Buster confessed in the morning, so the World had already gone to press. The Tribune got the exclusive on Buster's confession. And then my grandfather accused Sheriff Bill Field of making an arrangement with the Tulsa World that they got to cover Buster's reenactment. And so the event was just absolutely appalling. Is at once Buster and my grandfather that had already met, but there had already been an arrangement with the Tulsa World where they literally took Buster to the scene of the, in quotation marks, crime, and had Buster reenact the crime according to his coerced confession. And no one was even bothering to look at the confession, reading the confession as he's supposedly reenacting it. So, I mean, just the idea of that happening to a suspect the day they confessed is mind-boggling. And it just goes to show the level of hubris that no one thought that they were going to get caught. It was all about publicity. I mean, they wanted to sell some newspapers.
Yeah. So that was really jaw-dropping as you're reading this account, that authorities would do that. Mm-hmm. The other thing was the use of lie detectors and how lie detectors were really thought at that time to be pretty much infallible. The immediate response after Buster does confess is, we need you to take a lie detector test, which he refuses at the time. And then eventually does. It doesn't exonerate him, but it doesn't convict him. It sounded like it was inconclusive.
Exactly like you just said, is they had him during his long, miserable weekend, had him, they were trying to coerce him into taking a lie detector test. The first time he just absolutely refused, and he finally relented and took the test. And this is another example of how you can modify the truth without telling a lie. Is he took the test and it was inconclusive, but Harry Stege told the press that it doesn't exonerate him. He has knowledge of the crime. Well, of course he had knowledge of the crime. Anyone who was in Tulsa at the time had knowledge of the crime.
Anybody in the neighborhood would.
Yeah, and certainly everyone in the neighborhood. So that's another example of just kind of manipulating the truth and kind of almost taking a PR approach to manipulating criminal justice in this situation. So, yeah, as you said, there was a perception that, and honestly, I think it still remains to this day, that there's a physiological response to lying. You start sweating, you start shaking, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's why a lot of the authorities thought that Buster had done something wrong because he was nervous. But again, of course he's nervous. He's, you know, in the basement of the Tulsa County jail, you know, being railroaded by the authorities. So of course he was nervous. But so anyway, the lie detector was instrumental here, and then it became even more instrumental later on in the story and was actually conducted by a man named Captain Philip Hoyt of the Kansas City Police Department, who he was the foremost practitioner of the lie detector test, but he was also a major innovator in forensic science, because we have to bear in mind this is way before DNA testing or anything like that. And he was a, like I said, a major innovator, and was really exciting to see what he contributed. And like we talked about earlier, is another example of a who's who of all these people coalescing around this one event.
Your grandfather, though, found numerous cases where the police and sheriff's department, which I have to remember, this was sort of both departments involved, the sheriff and the police department at the time, and
county's attorney's office. Yeah.
And he found numerous cases where, as far as dotting the I's and crossing the T's, nobody checked out his alibi.
Right. Nobody checked the bars where Buster said he went. The truly disturbing thing is no one bothered to autopsy the girl until weeks into, not the trial, but, you know, before the post-mortem murder investigation, once Buster was charged, they autopsied the girl weeks later. And that was probably the most disturbing part. But yeah, as you mentioned, no one checked the alibis. No other suspect was seriously questioned. So it as my grandfather said throughout, Buster was just the suspect from the word go. And they went out of their way to do everything possible to support that.
In fact, one of the corroborating pieces of evidence, which the county was presenting as debunking the alibi, a juror in the courtroom actually picks out the fact that it had been altered.
Right. And then even then, the situation was, is a key part of Buster's alibi, my grandfather's alibi, is that he had been out drinking, as I said. And so they had paid a ticket to cooperate, to coalesce, because the bartender said he was there that night, and then they also had this ticket. Well, anyway, the ticket would have been March 13th, but anyway, it had been written over to say March 14th, thus destroying the alibi. And then a juror had, as you said, noticed that and pointed out that this piece of evidence had been tampered with. And nothing was done about that because, I mean, that's criminal. And in fact, just a person came out and said, well, sometimes if we get it at midnight, that's what we do, is we'll just modify the dates on it. But the thing that I took away from investigating this in regards to, like, for lack of better words, my awareness of my grandfather, because we talked about what I knew about it. All I knew about was the overarching story. But I learned a lot about him. It's who he was at 33 years old, 30 years before I even met him. And that is that this is clearly a guy who is in over his head, and he would admit as much, because he was a public defender making $250 a month going against the county attorney's office. He was in over his head going against Robert E. Wheeler, a very skilled attorney, and then likewise J. Howard Edmondson, who is known for being a cutthroat, bare-knuckle boxer as far as being a prosecutor. But my grandfather was on the side of right. And so that was what ultimately made the difference, and it just became so egregious what was being done. And it was disturbing that 9 out of 10 people would have just let well enough alone and just said, you know what, this guy, even if things look a little crooked, you know, he'll just go to prison and that'll be that. And my grandfather just wasn't accepting of that.
And you also write at the time that he was not a popular guy in town for taking this case.
No, and in people's defense, they didn't know what he knew. Because again, as we already said, if you're reading the Tulsa World and the Tulsa Tribune, then you're getting a completely biased perspective. But yes, as you said, he was shunned. And that was one of the things that my mom had mentioned whenever I'd first heard about this, is that people would actually walk on the other side of the street to avoid him. But in people's defense, I would say that from their perspective, you're talking about a guy who's 33 years old and is defending a person who confessed to raping and murdering a child. And the kind of the publicity machine had created the idea that he was doing this just for his own publicity. And then from the perspective of why would you do something like this? Why would you defend a person who confessed to this? But as I said, people didn't know what he knew. And then once people started finding out, including Troy Gordon with the Tulsa World, the conversation started changing. A big thing that I learned in researching this, and I'd already known, but this confirmed it within this context, is there's a court wherever you are tried by a jury of your peers, but then there is arguably even more important, a jury of public opinion. And so my grandfather, whether he knew what he was doing or not, or if this was just his pugnacious personality, he was changing the conversation surrounding Buster leading up to the trial because he knew that was important.
One of the questions I had was how much party politics played in this whole case, because your grandfather was a part of the Republican county attorney's office. They were displaced by the Democratic county attorney. And again, here it's the Democratic county attorney gets the former Republican assistant county attorney, going at it here in court. And I was wondering, as you know, because it seemed like it was very personal and that some of the exchanges you recount, do you think it had a role?
If it did, I didn't see a lot of evidence for that. The thing about this is I would say that things were partisan. They were intense, the issues between the two sides, but I didn't see any evidence that it was necessarily because of politics. Now, it may have been, but I honestly think that politics didn't need to play a factor in it. The factor is that there was a situation wherever the county attorney's office and the sheriff's office had not, as you said, dotted their I's and crossed their T's in regards to this very high-profile murder case, made a lot of mistakes, and were hoping that they could just sweep this guy, Buster Youngwolf, under the rug, and Elliot Howe came in and said no. And there was an element of who do you think you are, because this was before Gideon v. Wainwright. This was before Miranda. The idea of public defense, it was a non-issue. There were, in the entire United States of America, there were less than 50 public defenders, and some cities had zero public defenders. So it was almost treated as a starting job, like your first gig as an attorney was to be a public defender. And so the idea that a public defender would actually help someone who confessed to a murder and was being prosecuted by a powerful county's attorney's office was just mind-boggling to people. And then once it became more and more known just what had been done, it became truly troubling what they had done. And so in many ways, politics wasn't the linchpin of it. It was almost survival, because whenever they had done something this egregious, it being known would have been, you know, bad for their careers, bad for their reputations, and so that's what they were fighting for.
Mm. Was there ever the murder ever solved?
No, it's still a cold case.
And of course, the story of Buster Youngwolf doesn't end necessarily well. He goes back to prison for a parole violation.
Yeah, as we mentioned, as he lied about what he did that night, but as a consequence, his alibi wound up putting him in prison for a while. But what's interesting is my grandfather actually attempted to help him through that parole issue, and Buster just wasn't very helpful as far as providing the support that my grandfather needed, and so Buster wound up spending some time in prison. And then he was actually in and out of jail throughout his life and always getting into trouble. So this isn't a Hollywood movie where everyone, you know, walks off into the sunset and everyone lives happily ever after. The point of this is less, as I said, it's less the Hollywood ending and more that this is a situation where someone didn't do something wrong and could have potentially lost their life because of that, and someone standing up for them. And that's what matters.
Hunter Howell Cates is the author of Oklahoma's Atticus, An Innocent Man and the Lawyer Who Fought for Him. It's published by Bison Books. He'll be speaking about the book this Thursday at 7 o'clock at an event at Magic City Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.